guys are, I have no sausages, I'm sorry. Mostly words. I'm very text biased. And so my slides are mostly just to keep us all on target. So I don't wander off my points too much, although I always have to do a little wandering, I think. And I have my trusty alarm clock here because I no longer own the watch. My kids talked me out of owning the watch. They said it's very passe, and so I have a cell phone. But I can't really look at my cell phone while I'm trying to talk, so they're coming back to the alarm clock. Okay, so I represent a community, actually, of scholarship that takes science communication, what we're really talking about here today, for the most part, and turns it into a research project. So the journal that I publish is actually research about some of these issues. Not so much about journal issues, although we're open to that, but a little more central to our scholarship is usually research about publics and audiences for science communication products. So we're trying to get, as Xiaoqing illustrated, we're trying to get information about science out to the public, whatever that is, in a world in which more and more science journalists are actually disappearing, losing their jobs, becoming freelancers, maybe having more fun, but a little bit less job security, like journalists of all kinds. So this creates a lot of tensions and shifts. And with, so far this morning, the big piece of the equation that we haven't talked a lot about is why are we doing this and who are we doing this for? And so I'm going to talk about audiences for science, just to kind of scratch the surface of what's a huge topic. And for us, for the people in my research community, this is a huge research project. We're having literature on audiences and publics and how people think about science and public attitudes and public understanding and public engagement. The new trend for getting science out is to engage people, scientists going out into the community and to some extent becoming activists. I have a little chat on the break about that concept, but at least in a sense, not necessarily in all cases of being movers and shakers sometimes, but even in smaller ways, simply the concept that scientists should go out in the community and talk to people about their work is kind of novel. And I have to say, I always think of this, and I thought of this morning during several of the talks. My son is a theoretical particle physicist, and he doesn't believe in public communication science at all. His papers are completely mathematical. I cannot read them. Only his close colleagues can read them. He uses the archive, not interested in traditional journal publications at all. And I think, hopefully he'll never hear this comment, I think it's a little bit rebellion because my career has been organized around science and science communication, so he went into a field in which that's irrelevant. But I have to say that the physicists are a little bit to blame for the emphasis.
I'm a geologist.
Oh, you're a geologist, okay. The physical scientists, you're a physical scientist, right? A little bit to blame for the lack of public communication in their fields, as opposed to biology. News editors also know that biology and public health in particular are very popular with audiences. Everybody cares about that. Actually, people care about science too, but the editors don't seem to have gotten that. Maybe because there are fewer advertisers that are interested in advertising projects, products having to do with things like geology or physics. Okay, so what happens when science leaves journals? Again, apologies for the text-heavy character of my slides here, but they help keep me on track. Most people only get science secondhand, whether from media reports or from, maybe they know a scientist, but most people don't know a scientist. And despite all our efforts at public engagement, that probably reaches very, very few people where you actually have an event. The Science Cafe, we have a Science Cafe in Olympia, where they have one in Portland too, and I'm sure there are others that I don't know about in the Northwest. They're all over, started in Europe. You go to the science cafe and actually talk to a scientist. In Portland, apparently, they do this over beer. In Olympia, we're a little bit more conservative. We do it at a bookstore, and maybe there's coffee. But very few people are reached by that, and they're usually people who are already already interested and enthusiastic about science. It doesn't really reach beyond that community. But most people, therefore, only know science from media reports. This includes advertising of products. And as we've already seen this morning, whatever you thought about it in these terms or not, science news is heavily subsidized these days by institutions, okay? So I was trained at the University of Washington years ago in journalism, and we were trained that it's very, very important that we remember as journalists that institutions are stakeholders, and it's always their point of view. Even though they're promoting something like science that we consider a public good, they are basically engaged in promotional activities, whereas journalists are supposed to be engaged in a little bit more public criticism and take the objectivity, which never quite works out in practice, but it's a good ideal, kind of take a step back and look at things more objectively. So it's a little bit of a problem from the point of view of the way I was trained to think about how journalism works, that most science news is coming from institutions that are basically promoting their own brand of science, their own interests in science, and science itself. And I'm a total believer that science should be promoted. There's a little bell going on in the back of my head. When we take journalism and criticism and out of the picture, we leave people in a vulnerable position. And climate change actually is a good example. I'm writing a book on climate change. And you see, I've only got to point one, so I better move on. But people have to evaluate competing claims. And they have to do so in a world in which there are fewer and fewer gatekeepers that tell them, that help guide them to which claims might actually be more credible than other claims. Whether we're talking about products, cell phones, foods, pharmaceuticals, pharmaceutical companies, right, are big subsidizers. I see ads on television every day about some drug I ought to be taking. Sometimes I go to the internet and look it up and pursue it. It actually has an influence on me. I think it has more of an influence as I get older. But this is a little bell going on about the problems of heavily subsidized news. It is a form of sales. One of the very excellent, persuasive, and worth reading books in our fields, written by a woman who's no longer with us by the name of Dorothy Nelkin, who was at Cornell for many years and at NYU. And the book is called Selling Science, How the Press Actually Treats Scientific Information in a Kind of a Promotional Way. And this is a two-edged sword. It's good, but it also creates this new kind of issue about how someone with no scientific training is going to distinguish a valid and legitimate and worthwhile claim from one that's just made up, like climate change doesn't exist because I said so, right? People apparently have a little bit of trouble sorting that out. So making journals more public is probably inherently valuable. That's part of the discussion of open access and so on. It sounds very democratic, but it will not, regardless of the economic model, which I'm not going to go near because that's a whole other topic, but it will not solve problems of how people make use of that information. It really takes a lot of unacknowledged skills. I'm a person who believes that the great unwashed masses out there are very smart and very capable. But nevertheless, some of my philosopher friends tell me I'm a Dewey, and I never heard of Dewey when they said that. Having said that, there's still an issue of the skills needed to actually sort the wheat from the chaff in terms of scientific results. So now the new trend, as the previous speaker mentioned, democratization of science, public engagement of science, getting people on board with science and also engaged in making science policy decisions to some extent. At least we want them to be able to be intelligent voters on the big issues of the day that involve science. But this requires, in an era in which traditional journalism has basically gone away, especially for science, new levels of audience sophistication. And I don't have those examples today, but even our best public vehicles like the New York Times aren't as good as they used to be, I gotta tell you. Significant literature in my field exists on how people process risk information. I can do 2 hours on that. Risk information specifically, people aren't very good with probabilities, but under some circumstances they're motivated to go and find out more, so we study what those circumstances are and how people manage that complexity, but this is a very complicated picture. I'm going to give you just one simple example from a study that I did with a graduate student in Nevada of how we might divide up the audiences. I don't want to reify this, meaning I don't want to treat it as more real, more solid than it is. It's just an example. But we did a little survey with students and we asked them a bunch of questions about their attitudes towards science, and then statistically we divided them up into groups. So I thought this example of how we might do this, same thing's been done for climate change, I've done it in the past for certain biotech issues, with different configuration every time. So this isn't cast in stone, but just as an example, this using nanotechnology and nanoscience as our example. And we came up with 5 groups. People who are basically very friendly with science tend to be, by the way, economic conservatives, at least according to our data in this very small study. They want policy to be based on science, and they trust scientists. Science, trust in anybody, trust in who your sources of information are is a huge, big deal. It's much more important than knowing a certain set of background facts. So these are people who trust science, like science, are very friendly towards it. People who are unfriendly towards science, basically distrustful of science, not very familiar with it, social conservatives, they sort of seem to wish science would go away. Moralists, they don't necessarily want science to go away, but they want national policy to be based not on scientific principles, but on moral or ethical principles. I actually have some sympathy with this group. There are some issues like stem cell research. Don't get me wrong, I'm all in favor of all forms of stem cell research, including embryonic stem cell research. But I have sympathy for people who have ethical reservations. Unlike the climate deniers, they're not trying to argue that stem cell science isn't right. They simply have ethical reservations, and as a citizen in a democracy, I think we need to listen to those voices, even though those voices are not speaking for me, it's not my opinion, but they're voices we need to hear. Cynics, people who don't trust any source of authority, no matter what you tell them. Environmentalists who trust scientists and trust other environmentalists, we know a lot about science, but their value system is a little different. They're less inherently interested in science and more interested in environmental goals, which may be facilitated by a knowledge of the science involved, and so on. So this is just one of many ways to view audiences, but it's just a handy example from my own work about how, in a particular context, we can unpack these. People bring their attitudes towards science to the table when they see a piece of science journalism or when they hear a scientist talking, or on those rare occasions where they may actually meet a scientist and talk to them. They bring their pre-existing attitudes towards science generally to the interpretation of scientific claims. That is itself a scientific claim that I'm making, but one that has considerable research behind it, not just this one little study that I used as an example. So, to continue just thinking about this, who's interested in science. And I put quotation marks around the public, public opinion, researchers, and public relations, people who study PR in an academic context, tell us not to think about the public. We have no mass media. We also have no mass public. We never did. Not a recent thing. But we have to think more specifically about who the various audiences for this information. Why do we want to get this information out? Who to? What for? And what are they going to do with it? Well, obviously, scientists are an important goal. Scientists are an important audience to reach, and that's a goal. Scientists want other scientists know about and value their work. That's reputation, and that actually translates into career advantage. It translates directly into grants, by the way, but it translates certainly into tenure. You have to establish that you have a national and international reputation for your work, and so on. Other people have to know who you are. People who make decisions about science who are not scientists. Policymakers, politicians. I forgot to put journalists on this list. It was on an earlier draft and I just forgot to retype it. But journalists, regulators, investors, consumer advocates, environmentalists, all kinds of people who are not necessarily trained in science make use of scientific information. This group's a little bit maybe more sophisticated about science than some of the other groups, but they're not themselves scientists. And then there are people who just think science is cool. A lot of kids' programming wants kids to think that science is cool. And that's not a bad thing. Science is pretty cool, or I wouldn't have taken the career path that I have. But in and of itself, thinking science is cool is, I'm not sure exactly where it gets us, but there is this other group. And as adults, too, people who are fans of science, who just think science is inherently interesting, who watch NOVA because it's fun, who read Discover because it's fun, read the front page of Science because this is what citizens are supposed to do, but also because it's interesting. And then a group that I'm very, very concerned about through all of this, people who have to make a decision in their personal life where science is crucial. So they may have to decide if they want to have a certain treatment that their doctor is telling them isn't, you know, essential, but be a good idea. This is the best path to go, but perhaps there are other treatments they have to decide between them. People who need to make decisions about things like climate change, other environmental issues, how do we manage the toxic waste in our backyard? All kinds of issues where people have to make a decision. Go into the grocery store, you have to make a decision. We just had this huge debate about labeling GM foods, which isn't over yet, apparently. And it's quite amazing to me. I studied public attitudes toward GM for many, many years, and everybody said people in the U.S. don't care about it, it's just those Europeans. Well, not the case, but for some reason there's been this extended delay in the public in getting involved in that. And so go into the grocery store, read the labels, what people make of that information. And then there's everybody else, which probably can be divided up into many other groups. So, all of this is simply a long-winded way of saying we need to think about the multiple audiences for science, what they do with the information, what is the ultimate impact of our information on their decision making, and how should our communication then respond to, or should it respond to, what it is that those various audiences and various publics want and need. Science literacy. What is science literacy? We want people to be scientifically literate so they can make good use of the information. Traditionally, we've measured this by giving people multiple choice tests. That's actually controversial for any number of reasons. There was a recent controversy, within the last few years, over one of the questions on our traditional test of science literacy to begin with, and that's the question on evolution. having taught in the South for many years, I'm really aware of the fact that there are lots and lots of people who know a lot about science, some of whom are scientists, they don't accept evolution. And it's really amazing to me that people can do this, but that it cognitively, how do they do this? How do they hold these two ideas? But they do. And there are lots and lots of people like that. So it turns out, if you ask people, these are high stakes multiple choice tests, by the way, because we want to be able to say that the US is more scientifically literate than people in Europe or people in Asia. So, you know, national policy responds to the results of some of these tests. National pride is at stake. It's not high stakes in the sense of getting into medical school or something individual, but it's high stakes for the nation. Well, it turns out, if you ask people in the US what the theory of evolution claims, a lot more of them will get it right than if you ask them whether they agree with evolution. Okay, so it's not as though knowing the scientific facts necessarily, under all circumstances, lead people to a particular conclusion or decision or attitude or however it is we want them to think. Those two things are largely independent, and in science communication research, we call this the deficit model. So it's a knowledge deficit. We think that if we fill people up with enough knowledge about climate change, they'll all agree with us that it's a problem. That is not necessarily the case. It has more to do with trust and a whole variety of other factors. But the statistics on factual scientific knowledge, in this narrow sense, measured with multiple choice exams, you can look up the NSF reports on this. They've been doing this for many, many years. My friend, and not really colleague in the sense that we don't work together, but my friend and acquaintance, John Miller at Michigan State, is kind of the international expert on these tests, so you can look up his work as well. The statistics are not reassuring. But recently I started to argue that what people really need to know is something quite different. What I call critical science literacy, which means critical thinking applied to the analysis, if you will, or applied to thinking about claims about science. So I don't really care how they answer multiple choice questions about how long it takes for the Earth to go around the Sun, which is the one that always throws me for a loop because I just don't think like that. Of course, it's 365. But the first time I ever encountered that question, I thought it was a really strange thing to be asking, and I didn't really know the answer to it, even though I consider myself scientifically literate. I'm less concerned that people can get those questions right, as I am their ability to evaluate the claims that they hear every day in the media and elsewhere about science. And I think that it's a different kind of knowledge and skills that they need in order to do that. I really think, I'm almost out of time, believe it or not, that's okay, this is the last of my text-heavy slides. I really think that what people need is a sort of a sociology 101 or philosophy of science 101 on how science works. They need to understand some of these things we've already talked about this morning. We need to understand that science is a highly social activity. What is the role of scientific meetings? Well, scientific meetings is actually the place where we forge a consensus on what constitutes scientific truth. That's where people put their scientific claims out, often before they're published, for their colleagues to evaluate. And this was the process out of which journals grew, in a way, from what little I understand of their history. What is peer review? What's the point? What does it do? When we talk about embargoes, one of the arguments for embargoes, actually they're economic arguments, right, on behalf of the journals and their self-interest, but one of the other arguments about the embargo system is, well, we don't want to give the great unwashed masses access to information that has not yet been appropriately peer-reviewed and published in the right place. So we're not going to talk about it. In fact, you know, in the Journal of Medicine and many other journals, they don't touch your work if you've been talking about it in public because you violated this ethical principle. And this is a reasonable argument. We don't want to confuse people. But most people don't even know what peer review is, right? They don't. I swear, if you go out on the street, even if you go out on the campus and go around and ask undergraduates, what is peer review science? I would be willing to bet actual money that most of them will not come up with a reasonable answer. They can't read journal articles. I used to think that by the time people graduated from college, they ought to be able to read journal articles in their own field. That isn't even true in social science, and I kind of doubt that it's true in science itself. Certainly, they can't read journal articles in another field. Even adult PhD scientists cannot necessarily do that. But many people don't even know what peer review is. What is this even all about? They don't understand the range of methods. People learn about experiments in high school. I'm trying to say too much too fast, I'm losing my words, but people learn about experiments in junior high and high school science classes. They go to a lab and they do things, and experiments is what science is about. They don't really know or think about the fact that science has many other aspects. There are many other kinds of methods that we use in science as well as social science. We use observation. We use theory to build models and then test the models and see if the predictions are accurate. Geology, well, there is such a thing, I suppose, as experimental geology. But historically, geology and biology were primarily observational in nature. And to some extent, that's still the case. So there's a whole variety of methodologies that we use in science. Experiments is not the same as science. Experiments is one form of science which you can use for particular kinds of problems under particular circumstances. Science is certainly the object, or the subject in some cases, of political and ideological debates. And I think part of basic science literacy in this critical literacy sense ought to be understanding that. That doesn't mean that science is whatever we decide it is, or that you can put aside, toss aside scientific knowledge, but there is a politics to science and there's a politics about science, and yes, ideology does get involved. And then as climate change, my current project certainly reminds us, uncertainty and probabilistic conclusions in general are inevitable. And that's kind of a window that the climate change deniers have exploited, is this fact that science is never certain. It's always subject to revision. But it's not a failure of science. It's the nature of how science works. These are the kinds of things that I would like for people leaving college, certainly, and really people who don't leave college, I would like them to know, and I think it's more important that they know these things than that they know specific scientific facts. Okay, so two plugs. One is, here's a visual. These are my only visuals. Here's a visual of the journal that I edit called Science Communication, in which we take all of these issues and we do research about them or analysis about them. As our field of scholarly inquiry. There are actually three journals in the world that I would recommend that do this, and then there's a couple of little regional ones that are popping up here and there. Science Communication, of course, is number one, but it really is probably the central journal in the world on this field. Public Understanding of Science from the UK is another one. As the title implies, and a little bit more emphasis on public understanding, but they publish many of the same kinds of articles on media influence and so on that you might see in my journal. The third one I always have to mention, not only because these people are my friends, the third one is published in Trieste, Italy. It is an open access journal that is subsidized by the Institute of Theoretical Physics there, so they don't get, they have money, they just get it from a different source than subscriptions. And in fact, that model is falling apart for them right now. It's not clear how that will come out. But the third journal you can find online is called the Journal of Science Communication. I mentioned it not only because these people are my friends, they're very nice, but also because I wish they hadn't stolen my name. Okay, so I am Science Communication. They are the Journal of Science Communication. This whole community actually has an encyclopedia out that I edited. I don't actually recommend you buy it. It's for libraries, for those of you who are librarians. I hope that you have it on your shelf, or you can also get it in database form. And it's a couple years old. It's probably due for an update now, but it does walk through, I forget how many pages, but it's big and heavy and fat, so I didn't bring it. Walks through all of the options. Very little in there about journals, but a lot in there about science in movies, science on the internet, public engagement activities, various discussions of science literacy in these sort of more philosophical and social scientific issues. What are the big agencies that work on science? What's NASA? If you've never heard of NASA, well, I think most people have, but even if they're not in the US, but you can find a capsule view in case you're writing a paper and you've never heard of NASA, and you're probably 16-year-old in that case, you can get a capsule view and encyclopedia of what NASA is and what its role in science is. So that's it, and I'm going to slightly over time. And hopefully we have the time for just a tiny bit of questions. Okay.
Scientific
results. So stay tuned. Time to move on.